Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 28 of our monthly Meet the Experts Q&A sessions with Sinton's employment team. And obviously, this is the last session of 2021. Once again, can I take the opportunity to thank you for all your positive comments about these sessions, for signing into them, for tuning into them each time. We really generally do appreciate it. We've got a record number of people attending this morning, which is absolutely phenomenal that a year and a half later, they're still adding so much value to you. So thank you to that. As with previous months, the employment team will answer three questions, and our speakers today are on the screen there in front of you, Senior Associate Elsa Hobson and Trainee Solicitor Emily Richardson. And if I just move on to our questions, they're the questions the team are going to be dealing with today. I'm going to pass you now straight over to Emily. Emily, good morning, and over to you.
Morning. Morning, David, and morning to everyone who's joining the Q&A today. So as usual, we're going to be answering three questions. We were going to be answering a question on things that happen at work parties, but like work Christmas parties, but we kind of thought that because there's not many this year, we might pick it up in the new year. We thought it would make us too sad to talk about parties when we're not having them. I was going to say if people have been fortunate enough to have Christmas parties, but maybe actually unfortunate enough that something's happened and they need advice on that. But anyway, that's one for the new year. So instead, the question that I'm going to be answering first is about holidays. So it's the second one on the list. So it's, if an employee takes too much holiday in one holiday year, what options are open to employers? So the first thing that you've got to look at here is how did it happen? So there's generally two situations where this would happen. So that's where it was a genuine mistake. So the employee didn't know that they weren't entitled to those days and they followed the procedure and then they were accepted. Or probably the less common example where the employee knew that they weren't entitled to those days and they attempted to mislead and then got the holiday days that way. Obviously that is less common. So in that situation, what you would do is you would just treat that as a misconduct issue. So you would take that through the normal disciplinary procedure and treat it in that way. But if it was for the more common example where the employee did genuinely believe that they were entitled to the holidays, and the employer accepted them, then it can get a little bit more complicated. But there are things that you can do, but you just need to be aware of kind of the risks that are present with that. So the first thing that an employer can do is actually deduct the holiday entitlement from the employee's next year of entitlement. But the thing that you've got to remember here is that employees are entitled to a statutory minimum of holidays. So that's under the working time regulations, and that's of 28 days. So an employer can only do this if the employee is entitled to more than that statutory minimum. And that's because you can't take any of their minimum holidays from the next holiday year. So they'll be restricted to deducting that excess holiday that's granted on top of that. And the other thing is here is that if it's not a misconduct issue and the employee did genuinely believe that they were permitted to take the leave, then there is the risk of breaching the implied term of mutual trust and confidence. So permitting the request and then creating unilateral variation on their contractual terms would obviously breach this. So the thing here is just to have a conversation with the employee. Obviously, I think we're more likely to be talking about just a few days rather than kind of a week or so. So a conversation with the employee just to get their consent would go towards acting reasonably towards this and hopefully solve that problem. The other option that employers can take is recovering the excess holiday as an overpayment. So an employer can recover overpayments in certain situations where they've unintentionally overpaid a worker, and that depends on a lot of situations and sometimes whether it's practical to recover these. But as a paid holiday is included in the definition of wages, that's why it's possible to recover the paid holiday in some circumstances. So deductions can only be justified if they're required are authorised by statute, if there's a provision in the employee's contract, or if the employee has given prior written consent to the deduction. So what you'd need here is to check the contract to see if the deduction is authorised, or whether the employee has given any prior consent to this. Obviously, if none of that applies, then the employer can't deduct the payments. But if they do apply, you also need to check beforehand that the deduction is not included in the exception in section 14(1) of the Employment Rights Act. So, but there is actually another alternative to recover the overpayment, and that's through the common law remedy of restitution. So that's where there's been a mistake of law or fact, and this sometimes allows recovery in these circumstances. Very briefly, the requirements are that the defendant has been enriched or has received a benefit. So in this situation, it would be the employee, the defendant, and they've received that benefit of the holiday pay. The enrichment is unjust, and then the enrichment was at the expense of the claimant, so obviously the employer in this situation. Again, though, it might be difficult for the employer to succeed with this. They may have a defence, so the change of position defence. This defence would be more likely if there was no misconduct, but obviously in cases where there is misconduct, they're not likely to have this defence. Also, not forgetting that all of this does depend entirely on the facts. So obviously there are potential methods, but remember that the facts will influence kind of where those risks lie. In future, obviously, to avoid this, then you need to kind of review any policies, kind of understand how the situation came about, and then just make sure that that system in place doesn't allow anyone to take excess holidays, so then it doesn't happen again. But like I said at the start, just having quite a frank, clear conversation about why it happened, how it happened, and then just discussing that with the employee to get their consent. It's, like I say, it's only likely to be a few days, so definitely having a conversation is the best way forward. I don't know else if you have anything to add onto that, but if not, that's all from me on that question.
Thanks, Emily. No, that's great. David, can I just check that I'm working? I've got a cued sign around my name. Is that working okay?
You are indeed, yes.
Excellent. Thank you. Sorry about that. To add on to what Emily said, I think the key thing is to have that conversation. And while there are remedies out there, you've got to be mindful of the fact that 1 or 2 days holidays versus any fees or legal fees or any kind of a fee really attached to recovering that day or few days is probably going to outweigh the loss that you sustained anyway. So it's just, again, from a commercial point, you might want to factor that in as well. So I'm going to jump actually to the first question, which we probably should have done first, but I wasn't ready because this is my first time back from maternity leave. So my IT equipment isn't necessarily, nope, this is not IT's fault, sorry, my fault. It's not up to scratch. So I'm a little bit behind working between two screens here. So apologies, hence the blurred background. So the second question, is how can an employer ensure that they operate a fair process when recruiting both internal and external candidates for that same role? So the starting point for this one is that any recruitment process must be objective, so you must be able to measure it. It's got to be consistent and non-discriminatory. This is because it's even more important really when you're doing internal and external candidates, because one, you have to maintain that relationship moving forward for your internal candidates in the event they're unsuccessful. And because those people work for you, they're more likely to raise those more difficult questions because there's a relationship there that's existing. An external candidate might be a little bit more reserved, whereas an internal candidate is probably less likely to be, especially if it's their choice of career progression. So it's important to make sure that you are doing everything you can to be fair, transparent and objective so that you can justify and explain and guide and help the candidate internally after they were unsuccessful for that position in the event that they are. So the best way to avoid this and ensure that you act fairly is to follow the Employment Statutory Code of Practice, and that's to evidence that you did not unjustly favour the internal or the external candidate, depending on which is your preference, because we all have one. In the event that you ever found yourself in an employment tribunal, it gives you that justifiable defence, and it, I suppose, it just it reinforces any paper trail that you've got as well to make sure that you're acting fairly and properly. So Chapter 10 of that code states that an employer has obligations not to discriminate against, victimise or harass job applicants or employees. Now you might think, of course, you're not going to do any of those things, but sometimes just the way that you hold the process, ask the questions, can actually be discriminatory or amount to harassment without you even knowing it, because it all comes down to how that candidate feels and what the questions meant to them. So this applies to the arrangement in conducting the recruitment process, who should be offered the employment and on what terms they should be offered the employment, and on what terms the candidate was rejected if they were unsuccessful. So arrangements refer to policy, the criteria you apply and the practices that you apply during the process, as well as the decision making process itself. You must also apply the same principles to your job adverts and consider any reasonable adjustments to make sure that your advert reaches that wider group of people that may be put off by any arrangements attached to the job. So when recruiting both for internal and external candidates, you're going to find the main risk is going to be discrimination. And while as employees, you always want to hire the best person for the job, Chapter 16 of the code sets out how you can avoid discrimination in recruitment and how to ensure that there's a fair process. While the actual selection process will involve different tests, that's depending completely on the nature of your business and the type of hire that you're looking for, there's always going to be elements that are applicable to any level that you're recruiting at. So it's really important that you follow some form of fair, transparent, objective process so that you can justify why a decision's being made. So follow a career and objective selection process. I mean, that's the first one. Provide opportunities to a wider pool of candidates and treat those candidates fairly and in accordance with the Equality Act. So there's the three guidance. There are some limited exceptions to those rules. So where the role has certain occupational requirements or you require positive action and certain statute provisions allow you to actually be discriminatory in your process. So it's also known as positive discrimination. But it comes down to a justification point as well, where the risk is indirectly discriminatory. I'm not going to go into the tests, but it's just worth being mindful that your role can justify certain actions, treatments and I suppose requirements in the advert and in the process itself. So make sure you factor all of those in as well. So things that you can do to ensure that there is a fair process. So prior to advertising the role, really think about the content. What are you recruiting into? What's the job description? So that needs to be non-discriminatory. So consider in restaurant business, you don't advertise for a waitress. So that shows kind of a bias towards women or an assumption that someone you hired to wait will be a woman. Be accurate in your job description. So be quite specific and make sure that it actually represents the role that you're going to require them to do. And make sure that you objectively justify the tasks and duties assigned to that role. So why are they needed? If you need certain things done or for them to be able to achieve certain things, why is that? What are the demands of that role that make those specific things really important? For internal advertising, make sure you consider how those people who may not have access to certain platforms that you're going to pass out the advert on, how you can reach them. So people on maternity leave, long-term sick or part-time workers, hybrid workers, are they going to get access to that job advert at the same time as everybody else? And they're not going to be disadvantaged by a late discovery of the advert because they've missed the first part of the week or they were working from home and it was sent on a platform that someone can't access remotely. So really think about those things to make sure that advert's reaching all possible avenues, internal and external really as well, to make sure you're getting the best candidates as well. Make sure that you're not just relying on word of mouth or recommendations, because that in itself can lead to discrimination claims, because you're going to get people who recommend other people, but make sure that they actually hit the personal specification rather than just being a friend of a friend, because obviously that's where nepotism comes in and it can be messy and it can kind of paint you as an employer in a bad light too, because ultimately everyone wants to think that they have a fair shot at a job rather than thinking there's no point applying because they've clearly got their favourites. So factor that in. Think about personal specification. So that needs to be non-discriminatory. So equivalent qualifications. We've seen the cases circulating about the guy in the police force that couldn't promote because he hadn't achieved a degree, which because of his age was absolutely impossible to do, but he had such equivalent experience that it put him at least on a par with someone with a degree, if not above them, and that was age discriminatory. So again, make sure that you're not specifying anything in terms of X amount of years experience as a criterion. Or if you do, make sure it can't just solely be linked to age. It's actually linked to, I suppose, demonstration or exposure to certain type of work. So there's different avenues you can think of, look at, without it just being completely linked to a barrier that has prevented someone with a protected characteristic from achieving. So thinking about the application process in advance, there has to be objective and there has to be clear selection criteria, which is very easy to measure. And that's to show that you haven't changed certain criteria to suit a particular candidate that you basically want to put in your position. So you need to, again, think about the job, think about the job description. What criteria do you need them to demonstrate to be able to show that they can fulfill the needs of that job description? So it's all a big circle, a paper trail, and plan that criterion in advance with a nice paper trail showing why you've picked it, what it needs to demonstrate. And you'll find that front foot work really then follows through the entire process. So it becomes more of a, yes, they've got this, yes, they've got that, and you can justify it as you go along. And if it was ever ripped apart, you can demonstrate where your thought process was at every stage of the process. Be careful not to put candidates with protected characteristics at a disadvantage. When you're holding the tests or interview, think about times, think about locations and format and content of the forms. Make sure you are clear and open about reasonable adjustments, flexible arrangements made for those interviews. It's just something you can factor in to make sure everyone can attend and have the best, I suppose, shot at getting the job. Make sure that if you can, that the same members of staff are responsible for all stages of recruitment, and that just shows that you've got someone saying one thing about one candidate. You want to know what that person's opinion is of the next candidate and the next candidate, rather than we all have different opinions on people. We all, I suppose, get on with people differently or view people differently. So it's important to have some consistency there. Only invite candidates to interview that have objectively reached the requirements of the application form and the job description or the test they've applied, and make sure that they're solely on ability to do the job. Don't start diving off into other directions where they can necessarily, I suppose, they can cling to as a reason that you've turned them down or they were unsuccessful. So you've got to keep them relevant to the role, stay away from chit chat. I mean, we all jump to things like family and living arrangements and things like that, but when you're really focusing on the job, you need to stay away from this. And it might seem a little bit impersonal, but if they don't get the job, it gives them something to cling to then say, well, I think I should have got the job because I'm great, but I did tell them that I have a child, so I think that's the real reason they didn't give me a job, because they don't want to recruit me. And it might be absolutely the first thing from your mind, but if you had that conversation, how do you then say, no, that wasn't the reason, it was because of this? And then you're in a battle of facts, and that's for a tribunal to determine, and nobody wants to find themselves there. Moving on to shortlisting, show your workings out like a maths test. So make sure you show why you've scored them, if you're scoring, or why you think that they'd be good at that. Make sure you justify that decision. If there's more than one person involved in the marking and in the final decision making, agree separately, then do a joint decision so that you can show that you've been objective, more than one person making that decision. Make sure you weight against each criteria. So similarly, in a redundancy situation, you apply weight to a criteria. What's the most important thing attached to this job? Make sure that you actually justify that and set it out in advance, so that when you're ticking the best people, that you can demonstrate actually they showed this, which puts them higher on this criteria than the other person. So, and key one, which we always say, keep a paper trail of the process. Show process for every single individual. Have objective answers as to why they were successful or unsuccessful, and show that you made reasonably practical steps to prevent unlawful discrimination. So you've actually taken active steps to make sure everyone's included and that the process was fair. It does take the fun out of recruitment a little bit, because it's always seen as a positive thing, and then you're putting all of these rules in place for something that's really positive, but it sets you off on the best foot. It makes you understand the job better that you're recruiting into. It makes them very clear about what they need to do. And it also gives you that really strong defence that if someone were to bring a claim because they were disgruntled, that you actually followed a fair, transparent and reasonable process. So they're all good things to follow. So that's it for me. Sorry, I waffled on a little bit there, Emily, but I'll pass you back on to Emily to do the third question.
Perfect. Thank you, Elsa. So the last question is the last one on the list. So we're trying to stay away from COVID related questions, but I feel like this is just far enough away to be allowed. So the question is, can an employer rely on a specific flexibility clause to require employees to work from home indefinitely? So I know in the question that it says specific flexibility clause, but there are two types. So I just want to cover both just for completeness. So the two types that can be included are general and specific. So general is where there's a general right to make any changes to the terms of the contract. And our specific is where it's in relation to something specific. So for example, where the employee works, such as a mobility clause. So there's three things that would affect how the clause is read and whether it could be read to allow this. So it's the type and the wording and the facts. So dependent on the type will depend on how it's read, but also each type has restrictions so that then employers can't exercise full discretion over how the extent of the clause is taken to. And then also it's the fact. So the fact of the employee who's been asked to work from home indefinitely. So that's the business that they work in and also that their personal circumstances. So looking at the first one of general flexibility clauses, this will generally be unlikely to be read to allow an employee to work from home indefinitely. And they generally enforce these in situations where there's reasonable or minor administrative changes with not much impact, whereas kind of working from home indefinitely is quite a big change. So it's unlikely that this would be enforceable. So looking at specific flexibility clauses. So this is obviously a right to move where the employee works, but there are two, this is probably more likely to have a chance of allowing this, but there are two restrictions that could possibly prevent that, and that's how the courts interpret this, so that it's quite narrow, and then also the implied terms of the employee's contract. So in terms of the court's approach, so the terms are crucial in establishing how the court will read these, and if there's any ambiguity in the clause and in the wording, then it's likely that it would be interpreted in the favour of the employee, so wouldn't be enforceable. So if the clause is drafted quite widely and not specific to the change, then it's probably unlikely to be interpreted in this way. But if employers do decide to make a change, then that's when the implied terms would probably come in, because employees tend to rely on the implied duty of trust and confidence to prevent an employer making any change, and so preventing them from working from home indefinitely. So what an employer needs to do here is to act reasonably. And the case of United Bank v ACTA in 1989 kind of set out some requirements of an employer and how they can act reasonably. There was one requirement in there about it has to be a reasonable distance from home, but obviously that wouldn't apply here. I don't know, Elsa, I don't know if you have any comments on whether that would go in favour of the employer or not, or whether it would make no difference. But there are other kind of things that an employer can do, and that's things like allowing reasonable notice before the change takes place, explaining the reasons for the change, other things. It's as well practical things, so offering assistance to employees, because obviously working from home will incur costs. So offering assistance, not only financially but practically getting that equipment, these all kind of contribute to the employer acting in a way that doesn't breach that relationship of trust and confidence between the employer and the employee. So that's the kind of terms of the clause, but then there's also the facts. So even if the contract and the clause does authorise the change specifically, this doesn't mean that employers will be fully acting in accordance, because yes, they might be acting in accordance with the contract, but they might be breaching other things. So that's, for example, statutory restrictions or common law rules. So for example, if the clause includes a penalty, but more likely in this situation, it would be breaching the Equality Act 2010. So the clause might allow employees to work from home, but this might cause discrimination. So if the proposed effect of the change would impact on a particular group of people with a particular protected characteristic, this would prevent employees from relying on that and that clause, even if it was allowed in the contract. So you've got to think about kind of the whole picture and all the considerations. On top of that, there's the practical considerations. So you've got kind of employee relations issues of having a workforce working from home. You've got to think about the benefits and the cons for your business. And also, like I mentioned before, about the provision of equipment and having that equipment so that employees can work from home smoothly and that it runs okay. And then you've also got the procedural issues. So obviously this would be a change of work. So as a Section 1 requirement, you need to list the employee's place of work. So you'd need to issue a Section 4 statement to outline that change. So in summary, it depends on the type of the clause, the facts, and then you also need to ensure that whichever route you go down, you act reasonably and have any justifications for making that change to the employee's place of work. So that's all from me. So I'll hand you back to David or Ailsa if there's any comments on that.
No, I think you covered it all. That's brilliant, Emily. Thank you.
Perfect.
Okay, thanks both of you. Just a reminder from me before we go, we are still continuing to work hard to produce and deliver useful and relevant content, articles, blogs, podcasts, videos, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintins.co.uk, should you wish to have a look. And that includes all episodes of these Q&A sessions in about half an hour. That'll be all 28 of them. You can also follow the employment team on Twitter at SintinsHR. I've just popped our speakers' details on the screen. If you'd like to discuss anything they've raised today further, please don't hesitate to get in touch. And as I say, details are on the screen. Next session will be Friday, the 28th of January, 2022 at 10 a.m. on Teams. And as normal, I'll send the invite round nearer the time. All that's left for us to say is thank you so much for listening today, for continuing to listen. Stay safe, everyone. Have a very happy Christmas and New Year from all of us at Sintins. Thank you.